Chapter 4. Fat Bodies, Starving Brains. In this chapter, you will learn hangry is now common, but it's not normal hunger. It's the first sign of a broken metabolism. When we get hangry, it means our brain is starving for energy, and this can make us behave badly. Low brain energy is known to impair our self-control and cognitive functions, and can even promote violence and mental illness. Many people snack to give their brain the energy that their metabolism can't, which makes them gain weight. Because this is not well known, people believe they lack willpower, blame themselves, and give up on trying to eat healthier. When I first learned what a healthy diet looked like and started focusing on using food to help more of my patients, I noticed one question coming up more often than anything else. What can I snack on? When I was working with the LA Lakers, snacking was their top priority too. I used to bluntly warn, there's no such thing as a healthy snack. For one thing, every time we eat between meals, we take ourselves out of fat burning mode and put our metabolism into fat building mode. Indeed, in randomized controlled trials where people consume equal amounts of calories, those eating more frequently feel hungry more often and gain more weight than people eating less frequently. But clients would get so blown away by the anti-snacking message, it simply didn't process. The next time I saw them, they'd repeat the question. So I took a different tack. When they asked me about healthy snacks, I'd ask them a question in return. How often did they want one, and why? Often, people said they were hungry just 2 or 3 hours after having eaten a solid meal. No wonder the question kept coming up. After all, it's natural to assume that if you're hungry, you should eat. But is that right? Should you eat every time you're hungry? Even though hunger is intimately related to the obesity crisis, there is very little research devoted to understanding it. So there's no consensus on basic questions, such as, if you get hungry every few hours, do you need to eat every time? Is it bad if you don't? Experts are completely divided on the issue of hunger. Some say that eating every time we're hungry will get in the way of weight loss, and that we need to use willpower and push the hunger down. Others say that by ignoring our hunger, we are harming our metabolism and our health. Some suggest we're not actually hungry, we're just addicted, since processed snack foods like chips and cookies are specifically created to be hyper-palatable, so we'll keep going back for more. But as we'll see in this chapter, we aren't snacking only because we're hungry or bored, or the food is addictive and cheap, or it's so easy to chomp through giant packages. We're snacking because thanks to seed oils, we have a kind of hunger that is almost entirely new to the human experience. These days, if you ask people to describe how they feel when they're hungry, you often hear something like, "When I don't eat, I go rampant. I go all over the place." A news crew recently did a man-on-the-street-style interview asking people how they felt when they were hungry, and that was the first response they got. The other interviewees offered, "When I get hungry, I act hangry. I say things I have to apologize for later. When my kids don't get their snack, they get very cranky, and they get agitated." Though the word was used as early as 1918, hangry was added to the Oxford English Dictionary only in 2018, perhaps indicating how very common a state it has become. My patients tell me that being hungry makes them more dependent on fast food and junk because they need something right away and cooking takes too long. Some are afraid of their hunger and worry about being caught without food, for example, while driving. "Being hangry is the worst thing when I'm driving. If I'm in my car while I'm hangry, that could cause an accident." This isn't normal hunger. Hunger could not have always been such an oppressive, intrusive experience, or I doubt our species would have made it to the present day. Our issues with hunger are a direct outgrowth of the fact that most of today's population is insulin resistant. In the last chapter, we saw that our high PUFA body fat doesn't give cells the energy they need, and so our energy-hungry cells slurp up oversized portions of the limited supply of blood sugar. This leaves less sugar for the brain to meet its energy needs. When our brains don't get the energy they need, it's just like the commercial says, you're not you when you're hungry. But as we will see, the problem goes far beyond moods. Low brain energy has also been implicated in mental health issues. Good hungry, bad hungry. Normal hunger is about nutrition. The sensations of normal hunger are mostly due to a hunger-stimulating hormone called ghrelin, which is tied to our circadian rhythms. When your cat jumps onto your keyboard at exactly 10 minutes till dinner, it's responding to ghrelin. The stomach releases ghrelin into the bloodstream around our normal meal times. Ghrelin travels to our appetite regulation center, located in a brain structure called the hypothalamus. When ghrelin stimulates our appetite center, it registers as hunger that feels nothing like hangry. It's a gentle reminder. Hey, it's about time to eat. I'm ready when you are. Often accompanied by a mild, grumbly feeling in the stomach as it releases acid and other digestive juices. If we don't eat, all this shuts down after a few minutes, and we no longer feel hungry, especially if we get distracted. Normal hunger can actually be energizing because the ghrelin helps us burn fat. And if your cat or dog starts acting wild around feeding time, that's from the extra boost of fat burning, which gives them extra energy. It might seem surprising that a hunger hormone energizes us, but nature programs us this way because for most of life on Earth, hunting or gathering food requires expending a good deal of energy. Today, many people take frequent hunger as a sign of a healthy metabolism. But as we'll see, more often than not, it's actually the opposite. This new, unhealthy hunger doesn't go away until we feed it, and it actually originates not in the stomach, but in the brain. This new hunger is all about satisfying our brain's demand for energy. The brain is both an energy-demanding and a uniquely sugar-dependent organ. It constitutes just 2% of our body weight, but burns 20% of our calories. Unlike other cells of the body, the brain is walled off behind a protective barrier called the blood-brain barrier, so it doesn't have direct access to big molecules like fat. The brain does have access to sugar, however, since it's a smaller molecule. While our muscles and bones and other vital organs all have direct access to whatever fat may be in our bloodstream, the brain does not. So the brain uses a whopping 25% of our blood sugar. Without a steady supply of sugar, the brain cannot properly support the complex activity it's performing for us all day. Just maintaining the electrical grid that keeps the brain alive accounts for a good part of its energy usage. Managing important bodily functions like blood pressure, heart rate, breathing, and body temperature demands a good deal more. Because the brain is so energy hungry, it contains specialized cells that detect minuscule fluctuations in blood sugar. These glucose-sensing cells are designed to help keep everything on an even keel. You can think of them as a fuel gauge, although they do more than just detect low energy. They can also take steps to fix the problem. One way they adjust blood sugar upward is by regulating your appetite. When your blood sugar starts to drop faster or farther than normal, these cells send an electrochemical impulse to the part of your brain that makes you feel hungry. These fuel-gauging cells in the brain also detect other sources of brain energy too, the most famous being ketones. If your metabolism is healthy, most of your cells can seamlessly switch over to using body fat when your blood sugar drops. If blood sugar stays low, the liver starts releasing ketones. ketones quickly get into the brain and are one of the brain's favorite fuels, so all is well, even if you don't eat for hours. But as we just learned in Chapter 3, when we are insulin resistant, all our cells have a harder time getting energy from fat and need to use more sugar. Insulin resistance also disrupts the process of making ketones from body fat, leaving our brain with no good fuel sources. This is why this kind of hunger can feel like an emergency. In insulin resistance, it is an emergency. Our tiny cells contain just about 20 seconds of energy reserves. When our mitochondria can't generate enough energy, cells can start to die. What is a ketone? Ketones are special molecules the liver makes mainly out of body fat. When our insulin levels drop, usually a few hours after a meal, our bodies start breaking down fat stores and releasing fatty acids into the bloodstream. These fatty acids are too big to enter the brain, but most other cells in the body can use them. To convert fatty acids into a kind of fuel the brain can use, the liver chops them up into smaller pieces, called ketones. Our brains can use ketones for energy whenever our blood sugar levels are low. The process of making ketones is called ketogenesis, genesis meaning making. Unfortunately, insulin blocks this process, and when we're insulin resistant, our insulin levels are often too high to make useful amounts of ketones from body fat, unless we are able to exercise heavily or fast for extended periods. The most important thing to remember from what we learned about insulin resistance in Chapter 3 is that it can make you feel like your blood sugar is low, even when it's in the normal range. Remember, insulin resistance is all about an increased need for blood sugar. As you get more and more insulin resistant, your body needs your blood sugar to get higher and higher, all the time, elevating your baseline. When it goes just a little bit lower than what your body thinks it needs, you feel hypoglycemic. And that means you might start feeling hungry while your blood sugar is still in the normal range, or even above the normal range. Can't focus? Some experts believe that no matter how little or how hard you concentrate, your brain needs about the same amount of fuel, accounting for roughly 20% of the calories you burn at rest. On the other hand, it's also clear that when performing any task, the area of the brain responsible for coordinating that task gets more blood delivered to it and uses up more sugar. So other experts suggest that concentration does require more energy, but it's not yet clear how much. What is clear is that we notice low blood sugar more when we're trying to concentrate, and the lack of brain energy disrupts our thinking ability. This disrupted thinking ability, or brain fog, is one of the 11 most common symptoms of hypoglycemia. So, how does this kind of hunger feel? Hypoglycemia can make us ravenously hungry, as if we've been starved for days, even though it's often only a little past our normal mealtime. One of my patients calls it zombie eating, because it feels like an almost mindless drive to consume anything in front of him. Other symptoms include brain fog, irritability, anxiety, fatigue, shaking, nausea, sweats, weakness, dizziness, headache, and heart palpitations. All 11 of these common hypoglycemia symptoms represent an abnormal kind of hunger that is a reflection of pathology, the medical term meaning disease. So I also call this list of 11 common hypoglycemia symptoms the warning signs of pathologic hunger. Of course, these symptoms can be due to other processes, so it's important to discuss them with a doctor before jumping to any conclusions. See Figure 4-1 in the supplementary PDF. I teach all my patients to recognize all 11 hypoglycemia symptoms because they are the best way to detect insulin resistance and to gauge our recovery from it. Importantly, When we're metabolically healthy, we don't get any of these symptoms when we're hungry, because our bodies are perfectly capable of keeping our brains well supplied with fuel for many hours, or even a few days. So, simply monitoring for the presence or absence of these symptoms gives us valuable day-to-day feedback on our metabolic activity. It costs nothing, and it can actually provide more helpful information than any sort of technology, including continuous glucometer devices, blood tests, and the $40,000 metabolic cart that athletes use to test their performance. The human brain has been in development for literally billions of years, so its built-in sugar-sensing technology is the most sophisticated, sensitive, and accurate on the planet. We just need to learn to use it. The symptoms of hypoglycemia fall into two groups. One group is directly related to the fact that the brain is short on energy. The other is related to the hormones the body releases in an attempt to raise our blood sugar back to where the brain wants it to be. Nature intended that these hormones were rarely used for raising blood sugar, and they can have additional negative effects on our moods. See Figure 4-2 in the supplementary PDF. Recognizing low brain energy symptoms. The two low brain energy symptoms are brain fog, or trouble concentrating, and fatigue. Brain fog is the most common, often making us feel like we're having a senior moment. But of course, it's not related to age. It's related to the metabolic need for energy. These symptoms represent a kind of temporary service disruption that, if continued, could actually cause brain cells to die. So in that sense, you can think of them as a metabolic dashboard indicator that your metabolism needs servicing soon or permanent damage may occur. Many people who experience these low brain energy symptoms also feel hungry, so they know what to do. Get something to eat. Eating will often end up raising blood sugar enough to solve the immediate problem. The foods that raise blood sugar fastest solve the problem fastest. This is why so many people crave sweet-tasting treats between meals, including soda, juice, sweetened coffee or tea, or candy, donuts, and pastries. However, even though it makes us feel better, it does nothing to solve the underlying insulin resistance. Hunger is one method our brains use to get our blood sugar back up. Depending on our metabolic health, that food-finding signal might be a friendly little blip on your mental screen, or a huge, noisy, blinking pop-up ad that makes it impossible for you to concentrate on anything else. What if we feel hypoglycemic, but can't get anything to eat? Hunger was plan A. When plan A doesn't fix the problem, the brain cells that detect falling sugar levels will move on to plan B. Plan B is to release the hormones that can raise our blood sugar levels back up again. These are called stress hormones. Recognizing stress hormone symptoms. Hypoglycemia floods the body with stress hormones, including adrenaline and cortisol. These hormones come from our adrenal glands and are responsible for the many additional secondary symptoms hypoglycemia can give us. The brain regulates their release by way of the vagus nerve, which travels down the neck, winds around the esophagus and heart, then keeps going down to reach the abdomen, where it regulates the function of all the abdominal organs, including the adrenal glands, which sit on top of the kidneys. This is how the brain boosts adrenaline and cortisol levels. These hormones tell the liver to raise your blood sugar, which solves the brain's energy crisis. But they have a multitude of other effects that are not so beneficial while you're at work on a normal Tuesday. Adrenaline and cortisol are the classic fight or flight hormones. You've probably heard about them in the context of our caveman ancestors running away from lions and fighting off enemies. In the context of a real fight-or-flight scenario, stress hormones are beneficial. They give us an enhanced focus on whatever is right in front of us, a compressed sense of time, and increased muscle strength and coordination. But in the context of pathologic hunger, when it's still an hour before your break, you don't usually experience all that. Instead, you can feel shaking, anxiety, nausea, sweats, irritability, and weakness. Because the vagus nerve also controls the heart rate and blood pressure, its stimulation can cause symptoms related to those functions, which include dizziness, headache, or heart palpitations. Thankfully, most folks just notice one or two symptoms at a time. The stress hormone symptoms are often more attention-getting and disturbing than the low brain energy symptoms. They can magnify the irritability associated with low brain energy, turning it into a nastier form of hangry than usual. They can also make it easier for minor little things to generate a disproportionate amount of emotional stress. Stress hormones help give our brain energy by increasing our heart rate, blood pressure, and blood flow. They put more fuels into the bloodstream, helping the liver to dump sugar and the fat cells to release fat. They also instruct the liver to convert the mobilized body fat into ketones. Let's talk about how well each of these fueling options actually works to solve the brain energy problem when we're insulin resistant. Fat comes from your body fat, which can't get into your brain. So that doesn't help. Ketones should come from body fat, but insulin blocks ketone formation. And when we're insulin resistant, we may not be able to make enough. That leaves sugar. Only sugar can help rescue us from the internal discomfort caused by pathologic hunger. So the body has to find a way to raise your blood sugar. One way, of course, is making you urgently hungry. That was plan A. The other way is to keep pumping out stress hormones, which can help your liver release stored sugar into the bloodstream while also completely changing our moods. That's plan B. Your body also has a plan C. Plan C only kicks in after a while as a kind of preventive measure if low brain energy becomes a regular problem. Plan C is to keep stress hormone levels elevated, which dumps more sugar into your bloodstream per minute and supplies your sugar-addicted hungry cells with just a bit more. Studies show that people with insulin resistance may have abnormally high activation of their fight-or-flight system all day and all night. By keeping you in a more or less continual state of heightened fight-or-flight, the brain forces the liver to ignore insulin, and this is how we start to become insulin resistant. As we heard in Chapter 3, the brain can do this because it directly stimulates the vagus nerve, taking advantage of its stress hormone releasing effects. These stress hormones can override the insulin signal coming from the pancreas, which is trying to get blood sugar down to the level where it belongs. The increase of stress hormones represents a metabolic workaround that elevates blood sugar to the point that the brain is happy, even though the pancreas is not. And it's a Faustian bargain because of where the sugar actually comes from. Breaking down muscle to feed our cells. It would be nice if we could make sugar using body fat, but we can't actually do that very efficiently. When our bodies need to make their own sugar, they have to rely mostly on protein. This process is called gluconeogenesis. Gluc refers to glucose, neo means new, and genesis means making. This is how our bodies ensure that we always have some sugar in the bloodstream, even if we don't eat food containing any form of sugar. Gluconeogenesis kept our ancestors alive when they lived as hunter-gatherers, sometimes in climates with very little plant growth. They generally had access to plenty of protein-rich game, even when they had no access to carb-rich fruits, tubers, nuts, and so on. Gluconeogenesis ensured that they were able to keep their blood sugar levels normal. However, no matter how much protein they ate, they didn't store very much, so they never had much extra protein lying around. This is still the case today. When we eat extra protein, Our bodies convert it to fat, very much like what happens when we eat extra sugar. Without a storage form of protein, and with very limited sugar stores, sometimes the only way for our bodies to get sugar is to break down muscle to release proteins that can then be converted to sugar. Insulin resistance accelerates gluconeogenesis, which accelerates the conversion of protein to sugar. Normally, the process of gluconeogenesis produces very little sugar, because normally, we need very little sugar. But when we have insulin resistance and suffer from sympathetic overactivity, meaning our stress hormones are abnormally high, the liver accelerates the rate of gluconeogenesis, destructively breaking down more of the body's limited protein supplies all day, every day, to feed the sugar monkey on our backs. In Chapter 3, we learned about a consequence of inflammatory fat called overfat, referring to the distortion in body composition, skewing toward fat. Because the authors used the wrong cutoff that the handy liver can easily raise our blood sugar many times over normal levels by pushing sugar into the bloodstream. These two are related. Insulin resistance keeps us in sympathetic overdrive, which cranks up gluconeogenesis, which breaks down muscle. In other words, when the liver needs to chronically push our blood sugar to higher levels than nature intended, it will make building muscle difficult, and it will make keeping the muscle you have more difficult too. This is another reason why I say that hypoglycemia symptoms are really acting like an engine needs service light on our metabolic dashboard. They can warn us about the serious problems of metabolic sugar dependence and insulin resistance. It's important to learn these symptoms so you can tell the difference between pathologic and normal hunger. As we recover from insulin resistance, our pathologic hunger will improve. Many people have told me they don't experience symptoms of hypoglycemia, however, even though they are severely insulin resistant. Some of these folks who rarely feel hungry turn out to be habitual snackers. Just a little bit here and there can spike your blood sugar enough to prevent pathologic hunger. It also blocks your ability to burn body fat and is not a strategy I recommend. The strategy I recommend is to prevent pathologic hunger by building meals with energizing ingredients that sustain brain energy and function without needing to resort to snacks. That said, when life gets in the way, there may be times when you still need a snack solution, and I give you the best options in Part 3. It does seem like some people truly never feel hungry, and in this case, it's essential to get a HOMA IR score and potentially make use of a special technology called a continuous glucometer device. Insulin resistance makes us feel low, even when we're high. When we are healthy, we don't feel hypoglycemic until our blood sugar level gets well below the lower end of the normal range, which is 65 milligrams per deciliter, or mg/dl. The medical definition of hypoglycemia is actually 50 milligrams per deciliter or lower. That number was based on studies done from the 1950s and 1960s, showing that people feel and function just fine until their blood sugar dips below 54 milligrams per deciliter. As we've seen, most people today are insulin resistant. And when we are insulin resistant, we feel hypoglycemic even when our blood sugar is normal. I found that mild insulin resistance makes us feel hypoglycemic when our blood sugar level goes under 75 or 80. As folks get more insulin resistant, this threshold goes higher and higher. Patients with prediabetes often tell me they start to feel hypoglycemic when their blood sugar is less than 100. And those with long-standing, uncontrolled type 2 diabetes can even feel hypoglycemic when their blood sugar dips under 200. Similarly, people with diabetes will often notice that their blood sugar doesn't go down to normal, even if they avoid sugar and carbohydrates, which may seem strange. Where is that sugar coming from? Stranger still, people with diabetes can wake up with a high blood sugar level of, say, 120 whereas after an overnight fast, it should be well under 100. And if they check an hour later, it will often be even higher, say 140, even though they didn't eat anything. Figure 3-4 in the supplementary PDF shows that for most people, blood sugar levels start rising at around 6 a.m., which is often before breakfast. None of this makes sense until we understand the process of gluconeogenesis. Gluconeogenesis enables a sugar-dependent metabolism to raise fasting blood sugar higher and higher to meet the body's energy demands. And that's exactly what happens with each passing year. Fasting blood sugars creep higher and higher. Once they go over 100, patients are diagnosed with prediabetes. Once they go over 125, they're diagnosed with diabetes. As the need for sugar creeps higher, the blood sugar number where the insulin-resistant person feels hungry and hypoglycemic creeps higher too. Controlling hunger with drugs. Pathologic hunger is an unrecognized and powerful driver of weight gain. It overrides the brain's normal appetite control systems, making us feel like we've been starving for days, even when it's just been a few hours since breakfast. Normally, the appetite control system receives satiety hormones when we are well-fed. Leptin, for example, comes from fat cells and powerfully suppresses hunger. Another satiety hormone, GLP-1, is released by the intestines shortly after we eat, also powerfully suppressing hunger. Scientists recently showed that hypoglycemia completely and powerfully overrides this system to cause significant increase in food intake in experimental animals. In one experiment, animals tripled their food intake and generally behaved as if they were desperately hungry. See Figure 4-3 in the supplementary PDF. This finding helps to explain why weight loss is such a struggle for even the most motivated among us. New appetite-suppressing drugs such as Ozempic and Wegovy can override the override, giving people much-needed relief from the discomforting stress signals coming in from all over their bodies. Such signals may be the chemical explanation for food noise, a term for constant hunger and disruptive cravings. These drugs help people cut calories with much less pain than they could otherwise. But people only need these aids when they're insulin resistant. When we're healthy, we can cut calories painlessly without drugs. Under normal circumstances, we don't need these drugs because our own GLP-1 and the arsenal of other satiety hormones all work together to prevent hunger between meals, particularly when we have plenty of energy stored as fat. These hormones also help us put down our forks after we've eaten enough by making us feel faintly nauseated, thus curbing overeating. Insulin resistance disrupts all this by making us hypoglycemic. Our appetite-suppressing hormone GLP-1 levels typically spike after a big meal, falling back to normal within a few minutes. Spikes are supposed to make us feel uncomfortably nauseated at the thought of eating more, while normal between meal levels help to keep us from feeling hungry. This system fails when we are insulin resistant. Enter the GLP-1 mimicking blockbuster weight loss drugs, Ozempic and Wegovy. These drugs continually blast a person's brain with the equivalent of 100 to 1,000 times the level of GLP-1 that normally occurs between meals. For about one-third of the people who take them, they work like a dream to suppress appetite. Although that figure may sound low, it's better than most weight loss drugs. But naturally, the moment someone stops taking them, the pathologic hunger returns. And for many, sadly, the weight soon follows. The root cause of this form of hunger is not a GLP-1 deficiency, of course. It is the fact that high PUFA body fat fails to supply our cells with energy. The drops in blood sugar that result cause low brain energy, a metabolic emergency that disrupts our concentration, sets off our fight-or-flight response, and forces us to go seek food. Fortunately, we don't need to fully reverse our insulin resistance to restore a more normal appetite. All we need to do is to prevent pathologic hunger, one meal at a time. And part 3 shows you how. It stands to reason that all these sugar swings, energy deficits, and stress hormones might put us in a less than pleasant mood. If this happens once in a while, that can disrupt your day. If it happens every day, it's going to change your life. In fact, new research links hypoglycemia and pathologic hunger to common behavioral problems and even to mental illness. The metabolic roots of mental illness. A research psychologist at the University of Guelph, Dr. Francesco Leary, had always disliked the term hangry, assuming people just used it as a convenient excuse for bad behavior. But one day, he got fed up with hearing about it and decided to tackle this issue directly. Doubtful that blood sugar would ever go low enough to impact mood, Dr. Leary designed a study to prove that the whole idea was wrong. "I was skeptical when people would tell me that they get grouchy if they don't eat," he said in a press release. But his research soon convinced him otherwise. In 2018, the journal Psychopharmacology published his experiments suggesting that small but rapid drops in glucose levels could have a lasting negative effect on our emotional states. It was a landmark study because it was the first to show a clear link between the brain's ability to access the energy it needs and mental health. The experiment tested mice for anxiety using a standardized conditioning procedure that mimicked human anxiety disorders. Conditioning associates an emotional state with something in the environment. For example, ringing a dinner bell at feeding time conditions dogs to start salivating when they hear a bell. Dr. Leary's team conditioned a group of mice by injecting them with a glucose metabolism blocker that gave them a temporary case of low blood sugar, and then stuck each mouse in a new little chamber to condition them to associate that chamber with whatever emotional state they were in. They did the same with a control group, but those mice got an injection of water instead. Once conditioned, the groups were ready for the anxiety test. For the test, both groups of mice were injected with water and then given a choice of two chambers, the conditioning chamber or a new one. The mice who'd experienced hypoglycemia actively avoided the conditioning chamber, indicating that hypoglycemia made them anxious. In contrast, the control group showed no such aversion. In a third phase of the test, both groups of mice got an anti-anxiety medication that also treats depression. With the drug on board, mice who'd previously avoided the chamber no longer did, further solidifying the fact that low blood sugar had created behaviors mimicking human anxiety disorders and depressed moods. Doctors have long known that people with serious mental illness are more likely to suffer from metabolic syndrome. This line of research suggests that the metabolic issue could be causative. Dr. Thomas Horman, a co-author on the 2018 paper, said in a press release that when people think about negative mood states and stress, they think about the psychological factors, not necessarily the metabolic factors. He also included the data in his PhD thesis, where he goes so far as to suggest that our thinking on anxiety and depression is due for a sea change. He noted that low blood sugar triggers stress hormone release and is a stressor that can cause mood disturbances that may lead to the development of depression or depressive-like symptoms. He further suggested that insulin resistance might be a root cause of other affective disorders, including not just anxiety and depression, but also panic disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, obsessive-compulsive disorder, phobias, and bipolar disorder. This concept has implications for all of psychology. Right now, the bulk of research into the physical origins of mental illness focuses on root causes that those who are affected can do little to mitigate. Historically, the accepted biological roots of psychological problems were limited to thyroid disease, certain vitamin deficiencies, and tumors. In the 1980s, psychiatrists theorized that lower levels of neurotransmitters, such as serotonin or dopamine, might play a role. And they now frequently use prescriptions that change how the brain processes these chemicals. These drugs sometimes help quite a bit, but sometimes they also cause intolerable side effects. And often, they can lead to uncontrollable weight gain. Sometimes, they don't work at all. So, if mental health problems stem from metabolic disease, this gives anyone suffering from mental illness a new set of solutions. In Chapter 8, we're going to see that research into the use of metabolic therapy for psychiatry is starting to take off. If insulin resistance also affects mental health, then knowing how to properly diagnose it is far more important and valuable than we ever realized before. An abundance of published research linking hunger to bad moods, regrettable decisions, and antisocial behaviors, some violent, already exists. Psychologists at Cambridge University published a review summarizing dozens of human experiments from 2005 through 2021. They found that hungry people are more likely to experience negative emotions, such as anger, irritability, and rage, than people who are not hungry, especially in the context of stressful situations. They wrapped up their article with a conclusion suggesting that ordinary hunger has become a dreaded experience, as everyday levels of hunger are associated with negative emotionality. If that's the case, people may reorient their lives to prevent the unpleasant, negative emotional states accompanying hunger. They may be too busy thinking about food to be fully engaged in life. But because the psychologists leading this field didn't happen to partner up with metabolic health specialists, they didn't realize they were studying people manifesting the signs of insulin resistance. And so, they couldn't possibly have known that their research also suggested that our epidemic of metabolic disease might translate to an epidemic of poor behavior. Losing control. Dr. Roy Baumeister, a leader in the field of self-control and willpower, is one of the most cited and most influential psychologists in the world. He first made a name for himself in the 1970s, after pinpointing the one character trait that would best predict our success in school, at work, and socially. The prevailing idea had been that success depended on a healthy sense of self-esteem. But Dr. Baumeister found that self-esteem can actually get people into trouble if they also lacked self-control. People with high self-esteem but low self-control tended toward violence and antisocial behavior. Shifting gears to focus on self-control, he soon uncovered the real secret to excelling in school, succeeding at work, and enjoying happiness at home. People with more self-control had better mental health, fewer money problems, and less tendency to end up in jail, engage in crime or abuse, become sexually promiscuous, or display prejudicial behavior. They also lived longer. With self-control, everybody wins, he noted. It is good for the person who has it, for the people around him, and for society as a whole. Another word for self-control is willpower. After determining the paramount importance of self-control to health and happiness, he focused next on what makes even the most disciplined people lose self-control from time to time. Here, Dr. Baumeister again broke brand new ground. His experiments collectively demonstrated that willpower requires brain energy, and that when people need to exert willpower over and over, their willpower gets weaker and weaker. The idea is now well known to psychologists as the ego depletion theory. To psychologists, ego is not about thinking highly of yourself. It's the aspect of our psyche that gives us self-control. While the theory is still considered controversial, it seems to be in line with common sense. It's like a muscle. It needs fuel. said Dr. Baumeister, speaking of willpower. For most of us, that fuel is sugar. And when we're feeling hypoglycemic, we don't have enough. Dr. Baumeister's studies show that when we're hungry, we quickly run out of willpower and lose control over our impulses. Over several decades of research, over multitudes of experiments, he found that when we're hungry, we are more likely to give in to any kind of temptation. This includes indulgent foods, of course, as well as impulse shopping, sexual encounters, illegal drugs, gambling, alcohol, and more. This is true even in people who normally have good self-control. Feeling hungry depletes our willpower and demolishes our motivation for just about everything other than getting food. Hunger also makes decision-making more difficult. It makes complex planning nearly impossible. It makes us give up when the going gets tough. And his work also showed that it makes us aggressive. But Dr. Baumeister wasn't really testing people who were just hungry. Given the 99% plus prevalence of insulin resistance, chances are that many of his subjects were not experiencing normal hunger, but pathologic hunger and low brain energy. So everywhere you just heard the word hunger, it really should say low brain energy. Remember, the job of our metabolism is to provide energy to all our cells. Insulin resistance disrupts this all-important metabolic function, thus depleting our willpower and our self-control. On the other hand, giving people blood sugar-raising foods vastly improves self-control. In various experiments, Dr. Baumeister and others have found that sugar helps people to persevere despite frustrating failures, giving them the will, or literally the energy, to push themselves harder to complete boring, detailed tasks. Sugar helps people to think better under pressure and to maintain poise while being verbally insulted. Sweet beverages can calm aggressive individuals who naturally tend to engage in conflict when provoked. And it can make strangers less likely to treat each other aggressively. On the flip side, these findings explain why so many of us seek sugar so often. Sugar can improve our memory and cognition, making us test smarter. It can reduce our impulsivity and increase our attention span, potentially allowing people with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, who notice this effect, to self-medicate. It can help us work through difficult decisions faster and plan our days more effectively. It's a cheap, legal, effective, all-purpose performance-enhancing drug. The irony is that we only need it because our modern metabolism has handicapped our performance in so many different ways. Fatigue, hunger, difficulty concentrating, and low motivational states certainly make it harder to maintain a healthy diet. One of the questions many working parents dread most comes up every day, right around 3 p.m. So, what are we doing about dinner? It hits us right about when blood sugar starts to drop, making complex meal planning more onerous. Low brain energy is likely contributing to the fact that 45% of Americans between the ages of 20 and 39 rely on fast food every day. It's likely behind the decision made by 62% of Americans to replace at least one meal a day with snacks. The cruel irony of these decisions is that we end up eating more of the vegetable oils that steal our brain power away. When speaking on willpower and self-restraint in the context of dieting, Dr. Baumeister points out that we're in a bit of a bind. I'm not unmindful of the irony of needing sugar to improve self-control. If it takes willpower to avoid sugar, but you need sugar to keep your willpower going, then you're going to need sugar to avoid sugar. Obviously, this is a problem. Dieters are stuck in a metabolic catch-22, where they need the very thing they're trying to avoid in order to avoid it. Dr. Baumeister's research does more to explain our obesity epidemic than anything coming from our obesity experts. On the job, at school, and at home, low blood sugar spells may be gobbling up productivity. It might be making us feel overwhelmed by tasks we know we should be able to manage, or it might be distracting us during conversations so we miss important information. The effects of metabolically driven mood and behavior changes upon individuals and society as a whole run deep and wide. They may even be magnifying our darkest impulses. Hungry for vengeance. Criminal psychologists tell us that the leading cause of murder is aggression. Behavioral psychologists tell us that the leading cause of every sort of criminal behavior is poor self-control. Dr. Brad Bushman is an expert in what drives us to hurt each other. He has been trying to understand our escalating rates of interpersonal violence, particularly domestic violence, which he sees as an existential threat to law and order and the fabric of society. He has published over 200 peer-reviewed journal articles, testified before Congress, served on presidential committees, and consulted for the FBI. Dr. Bushman's many studies reveal a powerful link between hunger and aggression. And together with a colleague, the self-control expert Dr. Roy Baumeister, he designed a rather creative set of experiments that showed hunger can even cause greater aggression in married couples. But as we'll see, I think the research actually suggests that our metabolism, not our failure to eat often enough, is driving our bad behavior. First, Dr. Bushman and several colleagues recruited 107 married couples and studied their sugar levels for 21 days. Then they tested their self-control at the point when their blood sugars were lowest, which was, predictably, just before dinner. To express aggressive impulses, which reflect how much we want to physically hurt someone, participants were told, "This doll represents your spouse," and to insert between 0 and 51 pins in the doll, depending how angry you are with your spouse. You will do this alone, without your spouse being present. They found that people with lower glucose levels consistently stabbed their spousal doppelganger with more pins than those with higher levels. Those with the lowest levels of blood sugar stuck their voodoo dolls with an average of twice as many pins as those with the highest levels. One individual stuck all 51 pins in their doll every single night. Definitely not a happily ever after situation. To see if low blood sugar also made people more likely to act out their aggressions, participants returned to the laboratory to play a not-so-friendly game with their spouse. The rules were simple. Find out who can press a button faster when prompted by a computer. The winner earned the right to blast the loser with loud noise through headphones. The noise was a mixture of sounds that most people hate. For example, fingernails scratching on a chalkboard, dentist drills, ambulance sirens. The noise levels ranged from normal conversation to approximately the same level as a fire alarm. The winner could also determine the duration of the loser's suffering by controlling the noise duration, from half a second to 10 seconds. What did they find? Once again, lower blood sugar in the evening predicted worse behavior. The lower their glucose levels, the more the test subjects put their spouses through louder and longer bouts of suffering. In reality, participants competed against a computer, not their spouse, so no eardrums were harmed. In a TED Talk presentation on the study, Dr. Bushman offered this advice: don't talk about anything important with your spouse on an empty stomach. Of course, domestic violence is no joke, and it doesn't all boil down to low blood sugar. Low blood sugar does, however, seem to play a meaningful role. In an interview about the study, Dr. Bushman explained how low blood sugar translates to such antisocial behaviors. It's straightforward, he said. Glucose provides the energy the brain needs to exercise self-control. When glucose levels are low, we lose self-control, and any aggressive impulses we have may be expressed. I would add that the surging adrenaline our bodies release during episodes of hypoglycemia can't help either. He and others in this field tell us that low blood glucose can be one of many factors that predispose to aggressive behavior. Similar research shows that being hungry makes us every bit as aggressive toward strangers as toward a loved one. Here's why I think that all this research points to our underlying metabolic problem of insulin resistance. In all these experiments, there's something fascinating and quite terrifying that the researchers do not pick up on. People's reportedly low blood sugars are actually squarely within normal range, 70 milligrams per deciliter or higher. Not even the angriest people with the most aggression had what doctors would consider clinically meaningful hypoglycemia, a level of 50 milligrams per deciliter or lower. It would be one thing if folks were truly on the verge of starving when their behavior deteriorated, but that's not what psychologists are finding. They're showing that people deemed to be in good health are regressing to an antisocial behavioral state, but they are not actually in good health. We know they're likely to be suffering from undiagnosed insulin resistance, as is 99% of the population. And this means we can do something about it, besides wring our hands and move on to the next bad news story. The large and growing body of research linking feeling hungry to behaving badly is giving us clear evidence of a link between disrupted metabolic health and disruptive, childish, and sometimes even violent behavior. Unfortunately, since psychologists are not working with metabolic health experts, they're not making the connections they need to make in order for their research to get the attention it deserves. Right now, the media mostly pigeonhole this sort of stuff into their box of entertaining headlines, along with dogs who can dial 911 and rats dragging various types of fast foods through the subways. That's not where this information belongs, because the implications are deadly serious. One of the big reasons the world isn't waking up to this connection between insulin resistance and social disruption has to do with the bizarre medical thinking on hypoglycemia itself. Why most doctors don't take hypoglycemia seriously. In our current medical paradigm, most patients experiencing hypoglycemia are not taken seriously unless they're taking insulin and can potentially overdose. Doctors do take the symptoms seriously, of course, but once the doctor determines that the brain fog, palpitations, headaches, and so on are not due to other underlying disorders and are occurring when their patients are hungry, they'll diagnose hypoglycemia and simply suggest they carry snacks. Unfortunately, snacks don't always help once an anxiety attack or a migraine has already begun. Even worse, many doctors believe that having mild hypoglycemia is healthy. The assumption seems to be that it's a sign of a fast metabolism. Doctors understand that severe hypoglycemia can have serious consequences, but they don't typically understand that people with insulin resistance can have severe hypoglycemia symptoms even while their blood sugars are normal. Let's define our terms. A blood sugar below 30 milligrams per deciliter is life-threatening hypoglycemia. Between 30 and 50 is severe hypoglycemia. And between 51 and 70 is mild hypoglycemia. Below 50 is where doctors start to take symptoms seriously. Between 51 and 70 is that weird category of healthy hypoglycemia that's an unrecognized sign of early insulin resistance, and not at all healthy. The number 50 was chosen to represent the magical point at which low blood sugar goes from being healthy to problematic, based on research showing that blood sugar levels of 50 or less represented an immediate and long-term danger to the individual. The danger comes from confusion, coordination problems, and slow or disordered mental processing that could make driving or climbing steps and ladders dangerous. Repeated episodes of low blood sugar can have devastating long-term impacts. Studies on people with type 1 diabetes who use insulin and are therefore subject to frequent episodes of hypoglycemia, show that they can permanently lose mental flexibility, which is essential for getting along with others and solving problems. They may suffer from a tendency to blurt out answers out of turn, termed rapid responding. They might have trouble with decision-making, lose attention to detail, and experience spatial long-term memory impairments, which makes it hard to remember where they've put things or even recognize where they are. One series of studies showed that recurrent low blood sugar episodes can cause significant cognitive impairment and even dementia, which the authors dubbed, sensibly enough, hypoglycemia-induced brain damage. Given that recurrent severe hypoglycemia can contribute to learning disorders, behavior problems, and even dementia, you'd think there would be at least some concern about the possible harms of recurrent hypoglycemia at milder levels. Perhaps a more fundamental reason that the medical system treats people with hypoglycemia so poorly may be that the diagnosis itself suffers from a tainted reputation. At one point in time, ordinary family doctors were listening to their patients, diagnosing them with hypoglycemia, and instructing them about how to modify their diets to prevent it. They didn't go so far as to advise eating fats, but they did suggest using low glycemic index carbohydrates, which is the proper medical term for what I like to call slow digesting carbohydrates. But they were diagnosing so many people with hypoglycemia that it drew suspicion from academics, who thought doctors should only diagnose hypoglycemia with lab testing and not by listening carefully to our patients. They went on an aggressive campaign to shut it all down, calling it a non-disease, a pseudo-disorder, and most demeaningly, a psychosomatic illness, suggesting that the symptoms were all in people's heads. Hypoglycemia became a condition of ill repute, thanks in large part to these influential articles. While we've mostly moved past the abject disrespect, we still fail to properly diagnose people with hypoglycemia, even if they truly suffer from low blood sugar. The problem is so widespread that a UK nonprofit called the Hypoglycemia Support Foundation specifically focuses on this frustration, with the tagline, "Your symptoms may not be in your head." The problem with relying on labs for the diagnosis of hypoglycemia comes from the fact that blood sugar lows are fleeting, and physicians don't typically look for them the way I'm teaching you to do in this chapter. See Figure 4-1 in the supplementary PDF. Therefore, unless doctors see a fasting blood sugar below 50 milligrams per deciliter printed in black and white on a blood test result, they probably won't take hypoglycemia symptoms seriously, no matter how often they happen or how bad they make someone feel. But it's unusual for a fasting blood sugar to go that low, unless someone is taking a medication that lowers blood sugar or has a rare disorder. Another problem with standard diagnosis protocols comes from the fact that hypoglycemia mostly happens during the day while people are active, but doctors are taught to test their patients for it first thing in the morning. Even testing later in the day wouldn't necessarily show blood sugar being low, because, as we've been discussing, low blood sugar triggers stress hormones that quickly bring levels back up. Perhaps the biggest barrier to diagnosis is the fact that many people feel hypoglycemic when their blood sugars are normal, due to undiagnosed insulin resistance. Due to these diagnostic barriers, securing an official diagnosis of clinical hypoglycemia has been extraordinarily difficult, leaving most people undiagnosed. This is extremely frustrating for the many people who feel their hypoglycemia symptoms are being dismissed. Worse, it's preventing doctors from recognizing the warning signs of a broken, insulin-resistant metabolism. As a result, people are left to fend for themselves, even as hypoglycemia gradually hijacks their eating habits and progresses to more severe forms of metabolic disease. Fortunately, a new technology promises to improve our understanding of hypoglycemia. crazy for Cocoa Puffs. After decades of research neglect, small groups of scientists have started to propel the study of hypoglycemia forward. They've taken advantage of a tiny, innovative device called a continuous glucose monitor that adheres to the upper arm and automatically checks blood sugar. It was invented so that people with diabetes wouldn't need to repeatedly stick their fingers. With continuous glucose monitoring, or CGM, you don't have to guess when your blood sugar is falling and run to a laboratory hoping that you catch it in the act. It wouldn't stay low that long. You don't even need to poke your finger with a home glucometer. All you need to do is glance at the number on your scanner. And you can even do it after the fact, since the data is stored in the device as well as in the cloud. The device has finally given scientists a tool that can catch those transitory episodes of hypoglycemia, so they can start to understand how it affects our daily lives. In 2019, a group of doctors decided to use CGM technology to find out if people who claimed to feel hypoglycemic really had low blood sugar. What they learned should put hypoglycemia and pathologic hunger on the map. They showed that people with hypoglycemia symptoms frequently had episodes where their glucose dipped below 70 milligrams per deciliter, and half of them also had deeper dips below 50. As we've seen, when blood sugar goes under 50, it causes impaired thinking and a greater risk of accidents. Fortunately, most of these deeper dips lasted less than half an hour. The authors pointed out that without CGM technology, it is unlikely that any of the participants would have received a diagnosis of hypoglycemia at all, since the episodes were brief, and most did not occur in the morning, when people usually go to the lab for fasting blood tests. Basically, unless you wear a CGM, you're not going to know if your blood glucose sometimes dips below normal. It's important to note that participants' fasting glucose levels were actually borderline high, with an average of 97 milligrams per deciliter among the participants. 100 is the cutoff for diagnosing prediabetes. This supports the idea that hypoglycemia symptoms are an early warning sign of insulin resistance. The other new finding was that in order to live with hypoglycemia, we basically start obsessing about food and dramatically curtailing our activity. Everyone in the study carried snacks. Some people even ate when they weren't hungry in hopes of preventing symptoms. Several reported avoiding exercise because it would bring on the symptoms. The authors raised the concern that these adaptive, but obesogenic behaviors were likely to further jeopardize overall health. I would agree. In fact, my own patients have taught me that insulin resistance can make it hard to consciously control your eating habits. For example, one busy mom in her early 30s told me, "I haven't had anything yet today," but she had brought a half-empty Starbucks venti caramel frappuccino into the room. Another, a law firm executive in her late 50s, assured me she didn't ever snack while sucking on a lemon candy. I mention this disconnect between words and actions not to shame anyone, but to highlight how a disrupted metabolism can distort our perceptions. If a food makes us feel physically better, then it's only logical to conclude that we needed those calories. And if we needed them, then it's hard to fathom how eating them could be contributing to excessive intake. In fact, another study I want to share supports the idea that we can develop eating habits that we're not even aware of. In 2022, investigators used a real-time brain scanning technique called functional MRI, or fMRI, to map out the areas of the brain that get activated as blood sugar falls. It turns out that as blood sugar drops, even before it drops below 70 milligrams per deciliter, it can activate areas of the brain that drive eating behaviors. Some of these areas operate below the conscious level. As blood sugar falls, it can cause a kind of subconscious hunger that doesn't make you feel hypoglycemic. It just makes you really want food the minute you see it, smell it, or hear someone talk about it. The investigator suggested that these brain pathways could drive addiction-like eating behaviors. They warned that telling people to snack to treat their symptoms is dangerously counterproductive, and that people could end up snacking either consciously or subconsciously to prevent further hypoglycemia. This research tells me that yes, people can drink Frappuccino and suck on lemon candies without really noticing. These authors noted that the addiction-like behaviors and unconscious eating were more of a problem for people with worse insulin resistance. They also showed that blood sugar doesn't need to drop below normal to trigger junk food cravings. Half of the study participants started to feel hungry when their blood sugar levels were still as high as 80 milligrams per deciliter, 10 points above the number now officially considered low, and 30 points above the number considered meaningfully low. Feeling hypoglycemic when we're not highlights what I've been saying about insulin resistance not being a simple problem of eating too much sugar. It's a complex problem of progressively needing more sugar than the bloodstream is designed to safely carry. As time passes and a person's blood sugar goes higher and higher, that individual may start to have hypoglycemia symptoms at levels no doctor would consider low, and therefore might suggest the symptoms are just in your head. Pathologic hunger is truly the scourge of our time. It's changing our relationships with food. It's potentially damaging our brains, and it's probably disrupting our ability to learn. Of course, the hunger itself is not the root cause. The root cause is the fact that our high PUFA body fat fails to supply our cells with energy, and that the drops in blood sugar that ensue cause a kind of hunger that I'm calling pathologic. Pathologic hunger is a defining feature of modern metabolism. If your metabolism is distracting you with fear of hunger, if you're spending even just 10% of the time worrying about snacks that you could be spending thinking about life, you're going to be making very different decisions than if you had a healthy metabolism. You might be turning down opportunities for adventure or for meeting new friends. You may not pursue promotions at work. You may miss out on relationships. And you will no doubt blame yourself for your failures, as will other people. Hypoglycemia stays with us for the duration of our metabolic impairments, and it increasingly shapes our day-to-day experience of being human. Still, medical science is barely aware of the problem and offers no real solutions. This is a sad state of affairs indeed. In part one, we've seen that a toxic ingredient has made its way into our food supply in a big way, with most of us none the wiser to its effects. How did we ever get to this place? How did we, as an intelligent species, get to the point where health-conscious consumers, truth-seeking journalists, and even doctors have overlooked the fundamentals of seed oil toxicity? And how did our society ever get to the point where practically our entire food system depends on a processed food ingredient that violently assaults our health? It's been a long time coming. For centuries, America's peculiar form of medicine has suffered from its own chronic disease, a disinterest in nutrition. This state of affairs set the stage for special interests to create an absolutely artificial fear of natural fats that terrorizes us to this day. We're about to learn how a misguided theory of heart disease opened the door for special interests to first hijack the entire science of nutrition and then to hijack our health. As you'll see, the entanglements between the vegetable oil industry and the healthcare industry run deep and wide. And they're harder to see because of one word, cholesterol.